When you sent in this BuzzFeed article, there's a big reason why menopausal women are worried about Project 2025. I gotta admit, my first thought was, menopause and politics, that's kind of a weird combo. But the more I read, the more I was like, oh wow, these two things, they really do overlap, especially when you start talking about healthcare and access.
Yeah, it really does highlight, a lot of women, I think, have this kind of simmering fear. Like, you're going through menopause, you've got all these changes going on, physical changes, emotional changes, and then suddenly it feels like, boom, this political thing drops. And it's like, wait a minute, what's going on here?
Yeah, it's like a personal earthquake. So for our listeners who maybe aren't super familiar with all of this, can we just back up for a sec and explain what Project 2025 actually is?
Sure, Project 2025. It's basically this policy roadmap. It was put together by the Heritage Foundation, which is a conservative think tank, and it's laying out their vision for what they want to see happen if a Republican wins the presidency in the future. I think it's important to remember, though, that it is just a roadmap. It's not actual legislation, at least not yet, but it does give us some insight into, what direction some policymakers might want to go in.
Okay, so it's like a wish list, basically. But how does menopause even fit into this? The article doesn't exactly paint a pretty picture.
Well, this is where it gets interesting. Project 2025 doesn't specifically mention menopause, but it really zeroes in on limiting access to things like birth control and medication abortion. And that's where the connection comes in, hormones.
Ah, I see where you're going. So it's not about menopause itself, but about the potential consequences of restricting access to hormones more broadly.
Exactly. Hormones are a huge part of managing menopausal symptoms, and that's what a lot of women are worried about. The article even points out how hormone medications like HRT, hormone replacement therapy, are used for so much more than just menopause. We're talking birth control, treating things like endometriosis, even gender-affirming care for transgender people.
Wow, I never really thought about how interconnected all these different areas of healthcare are. It's like this big web.
It really is, and that's what makes this potentially so impactful. The article even talks about the author's own experience. They had cancer treatment and they were on a medication that's also used as a puberty blocker for transgender youth. So you can see how restricting access in one area could have these ripple effects across the board.
It's like you pull on one thread and realize it's connected to everything. So where does this Dr. Michelini, the expert who's quoted the article, where does she fit into all of this?
Yeah, Dr. Mickey Nenni, she's an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at George Washington University. So she's really bringing that medical expertise into the conversation. And she's a big advocate for using HRT in a way that's backed up by evidence. And she's also trying to challenge the stigma that still surrounds HRT.
Yeah, that stigma is interesting. I feel like I've heard mixed messages about HRT over the years.
Well, that's because of a study that came out way back in 2002, the Women's Health Initiative, and it kind of scared a lot of women away from using HRT. Dr. Michelini points out that more recent research is painting a different picture. It's showing that when HRT is used correctly, it can actually be really beneficial.
Okay, so maybe not the bad guy it was once made out to be. But how does all of this, how does it connect back to these anxieties people have about Project 2025?
Well, think about it. If there are already these fears and misconceptions about HRT floating around, then the idea that politicians might restrict access to hormones just makes those fears even worse. The article even mentions a woman who's thinking about stockpiling birth control pills just in case she can't get them later on to manage her menopausal symptoms.
Wow, that really hits home. It's like this underlying feeling of, what if I can't get the treatment I need?
Exactly. And it's not just about menopause. Dr. Michelini is worried about the impact on all sorts of reproductive health care, contraception, safe abortion care. It all goes back to that web we were talking about. You tug on one string and the whole thing vibrates.
This is heavy stuff. We're talking about people's ability to get essential health care, potentially being caught in the middle of political debates.
It is, and that's where we see those anxieties about Project 2025 kind of morph into something bigger. It becomes about bodily autonomy, about trusting science over political agendas, and about how we value women, especially women who are going through this stage of life that's often misunderstood. But maybe we should take a break here and come back to all of that in part two.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I'm already feeling like I need a minute to process all of this. Join us for part two, where we'll be exploring the history of attempts to control women's bodies and how it all connects to what we're seeing today with Project 2025.
I think it's important to remember, all of this anxiety around Project 2025. It's not coming out of nowhere. We've seen this kind of thing before.
That's true. It's not like this is the first time someone's tried to regulate women's bodies and their health care.
Exactly. There's a long history here, especially in the US, of trying to limit women's access to reproductive health care. things like contraception and abortion.
And I'm guessing these attempts to, like, control women's bodies didn't exactly happen in a vacuum. Like, didn't these movements often target certain groups of women specifically?
You're absolutely right. We can't really talk about reproductive justice without talking about the systemic inequalities that have made it harder for some groups to have control over their reproductive life, especially women of color and low-income women.
Okay, so let's get specific. Are there any historical examples that really stand out to you as being relevant to what we're seeing today with Project 2025?
One that comes to mind is the Comstock Act of 1873. This law was incredibly restrictive. It actually made it illegal to send information about contraception and abortion through the mail.
Wait, they were literally censoring any discussion about reproductive health? That's crazy.
It's wild, right? It was all framed as this moral crusade, but in reality, it had a devastating impact on women's access to information and healthcare.
And that kind of moralizing language, it feels like we still see that today, like the same song, different verse. When it comes to debates about abortion and even contraception.
Yeah, it's definitely a recurring theme. People who are against reproductive rights often use those kinds of arguments, you know, about protecting unborn life or upholding traditional family values to justify their stance.
But those arguments kind of miss the point, don't they? When it comes to the actual lives and needs of women, it's like they're prioritizing this abstract ideal over the health and well-being of real people. And that's what makes this whole Project 2025 thing feel so unsettling. It's like it's ignoring decades of scientific research and consensus within the medical community.
And that's exactly what the article is getting at, about how Project 2025 could set this dangerous precedent for the government interfering in healthcare based on certain religious viewpoints.
You're hitting on something big here. This brings up all these questions about the separation of church and state and the right to bodily autonomy.
It does. It's a slippery slope. If the government can decide what kind of healthcare women can access based on one set of religious beliefs, what's stopping them from doing the same thing in other areas of healthcare based on other beliefs?
Okay, so we've got these potential restrictions on hormones, this anxiety about the role of religion in the policy, and this whole history of trying to control women's bodies. But let's not forget about the practical side of all of this. What happens if access to these medications is actually limited? Like, people don't just stop needing them, right?
That's such an important point. Restricting access doesn't make the need go away. It just pushes people towards options that are more dangerous and less regulated. We've seen this happen over and over again with abortion. When safe and legal options disappear, people are forced to look for alternatives, and that can be incredibly risky.
It's like that saying, nature abhors a vacuum. If there's a need, people will find a way to meet it, even if it means putting their health in danger. So is this a hopeless situation, or are there ways to fight back against policies like Project 2025?
There are always ways to fight back. One of the most powerful tools is legal action. There are so many advocacy groups and legal organizations out there who are challenging these restrictions on reproductive health care. They're fighting in court and working nonstop to protect access for all women.
That's good to hear. So it's not just about feeling helpless and anxious. There are people out there actually doing something about it.
Absolutely. And it's not just about lawyers and activists either. Everyday people can get involved and make a real difference, supporting these organizations, donating to their cause, just raising awareness about these issues. These are all ways to contribute.
It's like a ripple effect. All those individual actions add up and can create real change.
Exactly. And don't forget about the power of voting. The article really emphasizes how important it is to elect candidates who support reproductive rights and evidence-based healthcare. The choices we make at the ballot box can directly impact people's access to healthcare.
So it's about making informed choices and understanding that elections have consequences, especially when it comes to these fundamental rights.
You got it. And it's not just about individual choices. It's about creating a society that values women's health and autonomy.
You know, it strikes me that we've been talking about all of this from this kind of political and legal angle, but isn't there also a need to address the science behind all of this? Like, how do we combat misinformation and make sure people have accurate information about things like HRT?
That's a great point. With all the misinformation and political rhetoric out there, it's more important than ever to be clear about the science behind these issues. We need more doctors and researchers like Dr. Michelinenni speaking out, educating the public, and pushing for policies that are based on evidence.
That makes sense. But it can't just be on the scientists and doctors, right? Don't we all have a responsibility to share accurate information and challenge harmful narratives?
Absolutely. Having open and honest conversations with our friends and families in our communities can help break down those myths and create a more supportive environment for women who are going through menopause.
It's about building a culture of understanding and respect, where women's healthcare choices are valued and supported, instead of being judged or dismissed.
Exactly. And that's where personal stories can be so powerful. That BuzzFeed article we started with, it's a perfect example of how sharing personal experiences can shed light on these issues and connect with people on an emotional level.
It reminds us that these aren't just abstract policy debates. They have real consequences for real people. It humanizes the issue.
Exactly. And that's why we need to amplify these stories, create spaces where women feel safe sharing their experiences. When we silence those voices, we're letting fear and misinformation win.
So we've covered a lot here: historical context, legal challenges, the role of advocacy and political engagement, and the importance of science communication. But it feels like we're just scratching the surface. What about solutions? How do we actually move forward and create a healthcare system that works for women experiencing menopause?
Well, that's what we'll be talking about in part three. We'll look at some innovative approaches to healthcare access, the role of technology, and the power of building coalitions across different communities.
I'm excited to hear more about that. Stay tuned for part three, where we'll dive into potential solutions and pathways forward. All right, so we've spent the last two parts talking about all the anxieties around Project 2025. We dug into the history of trying to control women's bodies. And we talked about what could happen if access to these medications is actually limited. But now I kind of want to shift gears and talk about solutions. Like, where do we go from here? How do we actually create a healthcare system that works for women, especially women who are going through menopause?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? And I don't think there's one simple answer. It's going to take a multi-pronged approach to really tackle these systemic issues.
So where do we even begin? It feels kind of overwhelming.
One thing that's showing a lot of promise is exploring these new models of healthcare, ones that really put patients' needs first and make access a priority.
Like what? Give me some examples, because right now it feels like all I'm seeing are roadblocks.
Well, we've seen this huge increase in telehealth platforms, and that's a game changer for women in rural areas or places where it's hard to get to a doctor. These platforms let women connect with providers who specialize in menopause care, no matter where they live.
That's a great point. Technology can really bridge those gaps and make it easier to get quality care.
Exactly. And it's not just about virtual appointments. There are also apps and websites that offer evidence-based info about menopause, symptom management, different treatment options. It's about empowering women, giving them the knowledge they need to make informed decisions about their health.
I love that. Putting the power back in patients' hands and giving them the tools to navigate this stage of life, which, let's be real, can feel pretty confusing sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. Knowledge is power. And another important piece of this is fostering a sense of community and support, both online and offline.
You mean like those online forums the article talked about?
Exactly. Those spaces can be so important for women. They offer a safe place to connect with others, share stories, find validation, get support.
Yeah, there's something so powerful about knowing you're not alone in this.
Absolutely. And those connections can extend offline, too. We're seeing more and more in-person support groups and workshops popping up, creating opportunities for women to connect face-to-face and build those real-life relationships.
That makes so much sense. It's about creating that sense of collective empowerment and breaking down the stigma and isolation that can surround menopause. We need to be talking about this more openly.
Yeah.
More honestly.
I totally agree. And that sense of community can be a really powerful force for advocating for change, both at the individual level and at the systemic level.
So we've talked about telehealth, online resources, and the importance of community. But what about the bigger picture? What needs to happen at the policy level to make sure all women have access to menopause care?
Well, for one thing, we need to be pushing for policies that require insurance companies to cover comprehensive menopause care, including hormone replacement therapy.
Because right now, that's not always the case, is it?
Unfortunately not. A lot of insurance plans still treat HRT like it's some elective procedure or a cosmetic thing, which makes it really expensive for women who need it.
It's like they're saying that managing menopausal symptoms and preventing serious health problems isn't as important as other medical treatments. It just doesn't make sense.
I know. It's ridiculous. We need to fight for policies that recognize menopause care as essential health care and make sure that cost isn't a barrier for women who need treatment.
That brings us back to what we were talking about before, about valuing women beyond their reproductive years, recognizing that women's health needs don't just disappear when they're not having kids anymore.
You said it. We need a shift in how we talk about menopause. Instead of seeing it as decline or irrelevance, we need to see it as a natural transition, a time of continued vitality.
It's about celebrating this stage of life and recognizing the contributions and experiences of women of all ages.
Exactly. And that shift needs to happen everywhere, in our personal conversations, in the media, in our policy decisions. And that's where building coalitions comes in. We need to work together across different communities, bring together women of all ages, races, backgrounds, to push for a more just and equitable future.
Because this isn't just a women's issue, is it? It impacts families, communities, society as a whole.
You're right. When women thrive, we all benefit. So let's come together and create a world where menopause isn't something we're ashamed of, but something we celebrate as a natural and empowering part of life.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what's the one thing you want our listeners to take away from all of this?
I want them to know that we all have a role to play in shaping the future of women's healthcare. Whether it's advocating for policy changes, supporting organizations, sharing accurate information, or just listening to and supporting the women in our lives, we can all make a difference.
It's about recognizing that this is a collective effort. We all have a stake in building a more just and equitable world for ourselves and for future generations.
Absolutely, and let's not forget about hope. The fight for reproductive justice and equitable healthcare has been long, but we've made progress.
So let's turn that anxiety into action, our frustration into fuel for change, and use our collective power to create a better future for all women.
I like that. And remember, this deep dive is just the beginning. There's so much more to learn and to do. Keep the conversation going, keep pushing for progress, and never give up the fight.
And to our listener, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it's made you think, sparked your passion, and given you the info you need to make a difference. Keep learning, keep questioning, and keep fighting the good fight.